Actually, we're in the tail end of chapter 4 is where we left off last time. It was a couple of weeks ago. Last week, Brother Crow did Sunday school for us. But we left off talking about Solomon's groceries and, you know, the provision for his court. Now, this will be kind of a summary of by the time Solomon's court had grown, his number of wives, his number of ambassadors from other places, and his servants, and all of that kind of stuff. But the amount of food there was, it's almost hard to wrap your mind around, because it was, you know, roughly 28,000 pounds of bread a day. If you take all that wheat and multiply it out, you know, and if an ox, you know, hanging weight was 600 pounds, then you're talking about, you know, 20,000 pounds of meat. Even if that's a month, that's almost 1,000 pounds of meat a day. And those are the kinds of things that, for me, just kind of make your eyes cross, and you're like, okay, you hear it, but, you know, you don't necessarily, you know, make it compute. But that's kind of a summary of by the end of Solomon's time, that's where he had grown to, not necessarily how he started out, but, you know, that's where we left off talking about his groceries. All right, verse 29 of chapter 4, God gave Solomon wisdom and understanding exceeding much, largeness of heart, even as the sand of the seashore, and Solomon's wisdom excelled the wisdom of all the children of the east country. Now, where would that be? East from where? What's the reference point? East from where? Yeah, from Jerusalem or from Israel. Okay, east from here would be Shelby or Charlotte or the Atlantic Ocean, depending on, you know, where you want to go. Israel's a long way, but from the perspective of Israel, that'd be the east country, so east of there. What area would that be today? Iraq, Iran, Saudi Arabia, that area. But if you remember the Fertile Crescent, that kind of thing, you know, the area between the Tigris and Euphrates River as it would come down to dump into the sea, that area, the east, was known as an area of wise men. That would have been the area of Babylon and Chaldea, and those kind of things. And remember, in the time of Daniel, that was known as a place of wise men and so forth. But the east, I personally think that's the same area where Job originated from. But that area was known for having wise men and wise counselors, and Solomon excelled the children of the east country and all the wisdom of Egypt. Egypt was another place. It was south of Israel, but that was another place that was known for their education system and their library the wisdom and that was accumulated there. He was wiser than all men, and it listed a bunch of names there. Okay, again, chapter 4, verse 32 is a summary. He spake 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. That's all summary information. All right, now that brings us to chapter 5 in verse number 1. And Hiram, king of Tyre, sent his servants unto Solomon, for he had heard that they had anointed him king in the room of his father, for Hiram was ever a lover of David. They were friends, they were allies. Solomon sent to Hiram, saying, thou knowest how David my father could not build a house under the name of the Lord his God, for the wars which were about him on every side, until the Lord put them under the soles of his feet. But now the Lord my God hath given me rest on every side, so there's neither adversary nor evil occurrent. Now, wouldn't it be nice if we could say that, right? Solomon said, God's given me peace, no enemies. Verse 5, behold, I purpose to build a house unto the name of the Lord my God, as the Lord spake unto David my father, saying, thy son, whom I will set upon thy throne in thy room, he shall build a house unto my name. Now therefore command thou that they hew me cedars out of Lebanon, and my servant shall be with thy servants, and unto thee will I give hire for thy servants according to all that thou shalt appoint. For thou knowest there's not among us any that can skill to hew timber like the Sidonians. All right, so Hiram made a gesture of friendship to Solomon. Hiram and David had been friends, they'd been allies, and now he makes a gesture of friendship to Solomon. Solomon reaches out. Now, I think it's kind of interesting here. In verse number 6, he says, I want to hire your people, and you tell me what the labor cost is, and I'll pay it. There had to be an amount of trust right there, right? I mean, it really depends on the circumstance today if you just say, yeah, whatever, you name the price and I'll pay it. I mean, at this point, Solomon was not yet the richest man that ever lived, okay? He was the king, and of course, David had set back you know, quite a bit of store, and we'll talk about that, you know, through the course of the temple here. But he wants to hire them. He says, there's none among us that can skill to hew timber like unto the Sidonians. Okay, any of you ever tried to cut down a tree? Okay, I can cut down a tree if there's no building or people within 100 yards in any direction. Okay, and I have, you know, opportunity to, you know, back up and punt many times until I can figure it out. I am amazed at people that can eyeball it, figure out which way the weight of the tree is leaning, and cut it in the right spot so it drops exactly where they want it to drop. And, I mean, that's how I would equate this, but what he said is, your workmen are far better at that than our people. I'll send help, but I want to hire your skilled laborers. Verse 7, came to pass when Hiram heard the words of Solomon that he rejoiced greatly and said, blessed be the Lord this day, which hath given unto David a wise son over this great people. And Hiram sent to Solomon, saying, I've considered the things which thou sentest to me, and I will do all thy desire concerning the timber of cedar and the timber of fir. My servant shall bring them down from Lebanon unto the sea, and I will convey them by sea in floats unto the place that thou shalt appoint me, and I will cause them to be discharged there, and thou shalt receive them, and thou shalt accomplish my desire in giving food for my household. So he named the price. He said, all right, you're going, my price is, I want you to, in essence, feed my king's court. I want you to provide that food for as long as we're in this project. Verse 10, so Hiram gave Solomon cedar trees and fir trees according to all his desire. And Solomon gave Hiram 20,000 measures of wheat for food to his household and 20 measures of pure oil. Thus gave Solomon to Hiram year by year. All right, we're going to talk about what those numbers mean. But now, when we get into the building of the temple, we see, look down with me at chapter 6, verse 1 for just a minute. It came to pass in the 480th year after the children of Israel were come out of the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel in the month Ziph, which is the second month, that he began to build the house of the Lord. All right, so that is an anchor point. By correlating Bible history and world history, that date has been pretty well established as 966 BC. So from there, we can work forward and backward, forward to the time of Christ and backward in the history of Israel. Now, be careful who and what you read when it comes to this, because you read just an average commentary and they're going to say, well, this can't be right because the years of the judges adds up to about 410 years, and that doesn't account for the 40 years in the wilderness and the time of Joshua and the time of David and all that. Okay. The judges, some of them lived at the same time. They overlapped. Okay. So the period of the judges was not the full, if you add it up, just like, okay, easy illustration. Jeremy, how old is your oldest son? 12. And we're just going to say that Jeremy is 35. Okay. His wife will be happy with that because she's younger than he is. So, or not. I don't know, but I'm not getting myself in trouble like that today. All right? But, all right, so Jeremy is, all right, we'll say 40, and his son is 12. So that means that they've lived 52 years, right? No. You know, 12 of those years have overlapped, right? It would be just as silly as it is for me to add his age plus his son's age and say, well, they've, you know, it's been 52 years. I mean, it's in the same way, it's wrong calculations to add up all the times of the judges and say, oh, well, it adds up to this. Because at times, one judge was in the northern part of the country, another judge in the southern part, and they were working and ministering at the same time, okay? But when you add this up together, this date was 966, so working backwards, that puts the time that they came out of Egypt around 1446 BC. Okay, and that would put the time at 1406 of the time of entering into the land. And you had the lifetime of Joshua, then you had the period of the judges, which led all the way up to Eli and Samuel. Samuel was the last in the line of the judges and the first of the prophets. And then you had Saul and David. Okay, so all of that fits in there. But this is, you know, this is kind of the timeline that we're talking about. So when we talk about in chapter 5, the fir trees and the amount of food and all that kind of stuff, we're talking about 66, or that general time frame as far as the economy goes. All right, so Hiram, king of Tyre, was David's friend. If we needed this kind of, we need building materials, where would we go today? Lowe's. I can't imagine why that was the first thing on your mind. Okay. I would not go to Home Depot mostly because I'd have to drive 45 minutes to get there. Okay. We spent easily over $100,000, probably a couple $100,000 over the course of our building project at Lowe's, at the same store where she works. Okay. We also spent money at Cleveland Lumber and Sherwin-Williams and, many different places that we sourced building materials, okay? But there was no Lowe's, there was no Home Depot, there was no Cleveland Lumber. Where was Solomon going to go to get the building materials? Well, he knew where to get it, okay? And that was from the mountains of Lebanon, which that would still be Lebanon today, north of Israel. But Hiram, king of Tyre, his area at that time included Lebanon. Okay, so now, what materials did he ask for? Well, specifically, he said he wanted cedar trees out of Lebanon. In verse number 8, when Hiram is answering, he said, I will give you cedar and timber of fir. So there's two different kinds of trees, which the fir tree is what we would today, most of the Bible encyclopedias and that kind of thing would say that the fir tree is what we would call cypress wood today, okay? So he wanted cedars from Lebanon and cypress. Now, there was part of that mountain range in the north of Israel that belonged to Israel, but the best cedars, the ones that he wanted for this project, were on the other side of the mountain, and that was the land that belonged to Lebanon or King of Tyre. Now, just so we can, try to picture this, I Googled, because that's what we all do, right? Except for Pastor Stevens. He doesn't do that. But I Googled, where are the cedars of Lebanon? Okay, and best I can figure out, it's what is in the area that today would be called the Kadesha Valley. Now, I did what we all would do, all right? What's the distance from one place to another? By driving, you can see there, it's 280 miles. By vehicle today, that's 7 hours. But 280 miles, that includes, coming over the mountains and crossing borders and all that kind of stuff. So you're, 7 hours, maybe a day. What time are we talking about here? Remember, 966 BC. What was the mode of transportation at that point? Yeah, my granddaddy would say, take Joe and Charlie. And that's what he meant. Joe, Charlie, walk. You got 2 feet, go. At best, you might have a horse, wagon, carts, oxen, those kinds of things. So if the distance to be traveled is 280 miles, how long would that take just walking? I mean, an average of, 20 miles a day or so on foot, that's how many days? Carry the one, about 14 days, right? Just to walk it. Now, that doesn't count, having animals pull a cart, pull a load, anything like that. Plus, remember, on where these cedars grow that Solomon wanted, they were on the north side of the mountain range. They're on the other side of the mountain. So if they were just going to come this way, like we would think of today, they'd have to bring them up over the mountain and back down. Does that sound like fun? No, it doesn't sound like fun at all. And they had no equipment. What kind of chainsaws was Hiram using? What's that, Doc? Yeah, he was using Armstrong. Exactly right. He's using an Armstrong saw and an axe. Okay, so they're using hand tools to cut these things down. They're using animals and chains, ropes, whatever. Once they get it cut down and get the limbs taken off and whatever, they're using animals to drag them. You want some interesting stories, get Doc Scoville to tell you stories sometime of how they used to cut trees in the winter and hook up the draft horses and pull them out of the woods in the snow and that kind of thing. I've read about such things. Thankfully, I have not lived it. Of course, it probably would have, it would have been good for me, right? Build character and all of that. But that's fascinating to me, those kinds of things. But this is what we're talking about. When Solomon is sourcing materials. We're talking about bringing it from the mountain range about almost 300 miles down to Jerusalem. Now, what did Hiram say he was going to do? Verse number 9, he said, "My servant shall bring them from Lebanon unto the sea, and I will convey them by sea in floats unto the place that thou shalt appoint me." So while this might be the most direct route for a vehicle to travel, this is not the route they used for supplies. Okay? This is more the route that they would take. So from Lebanon, they would bring them down the mountain and take them west to the port. They'd put them in the water there, and they'd convey them in floats. Now, how did that happen? Yes. I mean, I've seen illustrations of how that's been done on our rivers. You know, here in the U.S., sometimes they would just float them, and you get guys that are either very brave or very foolish, and maybe a little bit of both, that would walk on top of those things with metal rods and poke them and, you know, try to get log jams broken up so they'd float down the river. But that's how it was done a lot of times in the early days of our country. They'd be taken to the river, they'd float them downstream, and there'd be a catch point, a designated point where they'd catch them and take them out of the water and process them at the sawmill and stuff. So I don't know. I mean, maybe they tied them together in rafts, but it had to be easier to take large trees. We're going to talk about the dimensions of the tree in just a minute, but it had to be easier to take large trees and float them than to drag them or find carts. Now, the cedars of Lebanon, what is that? Okay, that cedar of Lebanon was a tree that grew in the high and drier climates, which was, you know, perfect for the mountains of Lebanon. Okay, not only Solomon was not the only king to ever want this. I mean, as far back as Ur-Nammu, which I'm sure all of you are familiar with that name, right? But that would have been, you know, in the Babylonians. As far back as 2000 BC, so 1,000 years prior to Solomon, there were kings from Mesopotamia, which, you know, Ur-Nammu, that would have been Babylon and that region. There were kings from there that would go as far as Lebanon and bring back the cedar wood for their palaces and temples and that kind of thing. So it was world renowned at that point, okay? But the average height of these cedars of Lebanon was about 85 feet. 85 feet. You ever messed with a tree that tall? That is very significant. Okay. How tall was that tree in Pastor Stephen's front yard that came down recently? Was it any idea? Okay. It didn't come down on the house. I drove by there the other day and there were ropes on it, and, you know, it had come down intentionally. So, but I mean, that tree was probably, you know, 60 feet. I mean, 85 feet is a huge tree. But it gets better. 85 to, you know, some of them measured over 100 feet. In trunk circumference, right, that is measuring all the way around the trunk, not across the middle once it's cut, but in measuring all the way around, some of those cedars had gotten as big as 40 feet. 40 feet. Almost. That'd probably be... Yes, and, you know, at least 15 foot across. That's, yeah, exactly. The sequoias and the redwoods is kind of what you think of. I mean, it wasn't quite that big, but 40 feet around would have been, you know, 12, 15 feet across once it's cut down on the ground. You ever mess with a tree that big? I don't think so. But, I mean, if you get a tree that's 40 foot in circumference and, you know, so 15-ish feet in diameter, you can do a lot with that, can't you? You can make some pretty significant beams out of something like that, couldn't you? But how much weight are we talking about? Would you say 3 times a telephone pole, 4 times a telephone pole, Brother John? 4 times a telephone pole high and that big around? How much weight are we talking about? How do you get that thing down the hill? That's what I want to know. Yeah, timber, yeah. You clear out a path, you push it, and hope it rolls. The problem is this end is larger than this end, so it's not going to roll evenly. Getting it down the hill might be the easiest part. Once you get it down the hill, how do you get it from the bottom of the hill to the ocean or to the Mediterranean Sea? I mean, this is they had systems, but what I'm saying is we tend to think in modern-day terminology, hook up the crane, put it on the tractor trailer, take it to the sawmill. It didn't work that way. All of this was done with hand tools. Okay? Armstrong saw and an axe and a chisel and a planer that was all done by hand. I mean, even today we use rollers of various kinds. Sometimes in the yard, if you're trying to move something that's heavy, if you can get, you know, maybe 6-inch plastic pipe that's sturdy enough, you can roll that and, you know, you roll it, then you take the back one, put it in front, roll it a little further, take the back one, put it in front, and kind of keep it moving. Years ago, we went to the Hatteras Lighthouse out on the coast of North Carolina, and that used to be right out on the ocean. Well, they moved it inland about 1,500 feet, about, you know, a quarter mile. And they did that. They had a section of train tracks, and they just moved it. And once they got past it, they moved the track around in front of it and just kept, you know, leapfrogging it. But even if they did that, what were they pulling the thing with? Oxen, horses, people, all of the above, you know. That just try to put that in perspective. You ever tried to move just a railroad tie by yourself? That's pretty significant. You know, much less trying to move trees like this. But that's the wood that Solomon wanted. He knew where the best wood was, and he went to purchase it from Hiram. So those cedars of Lebanon, they were massive trees. You could make any size beam out of that you needed or wanted to. But also, the historians tell us that there was a particular oil in the cedar tree that prevented dry rot and was a repellent for insects. So that cedar tree was also good for building because it was not as susceptible to termites or wood beetles or, you know, carpenter bees or whatever animals like to bore into wood. There was a particular oil in that that was resistant to that. So you had the cedars of Lebanon. It was used inside and outside the temple. And then the fir trees was cypress wood. It also was not susceptible to being eaten by worms. Whatever natural properties it had, the termites, the worms, the critters did not eat it as well. But the fir tree was a much lighter wood. Okay, so that was also used as well in certain applications. But both of those were sourced in Lebanon. So they'd bring them down the mountain. They'd bring them to the sea, and then he says, my men will get them as far as Joppa. Now, where's probably the most familiar use of for us of Joppa in the Bible? Jonah, right? So, but anyway, they came down that far, and then it was Solomon's job to pick them up at the harbor there and get them inland from there to Jerusalem. Is it any wonder why it took so many years to build the temple? And this is just the lumber. We haven't talked about the stones yet. Okay? Let's look at verse 11. Solomon gave Hiram what he asked for, 20,000 measures of wheat and 20 measures of pure oil. Verse 13, King Solomon raised a levy out of all Israel, and the levy was 30,000 men, and he sent them to Lebanon, 10,000 a month by courses, a month they were in Lebanon, 2 months at home, and Adoniram was over the levy. Verse 15, Solomon had 70,000 that bear burdens and 40,000 hewers in the mountains beside the chief of Solomon's officers, and that's 3,300. Okay, so how did you get this done? A whole lot of manpower. All right, now let's come back to this. You had the cedars of Lebanon, the cypress trees, which was the fir, and then you have hewn stones. Verse 17, the king commanded, and they brought great stones, costly stones, and huge stones to lay the foundation of the house, and Solomon's builders and Hiram's builders did hew them, and the stone squarers. So they prepared the timber and the stones to build the house. Now, some of that may well have come from rock quarries in Israel, but the way this is written that, you know, Solomon and Hiram's stone squarers, I think it's quite possible that some of those stones were coming from the mountains in Lebanon there too. I mean, is every type of stone equally valuable for building? Sandstone, limestone, that's kind of soft. Bedrock, that's what you want to build on, right? And so They were looking for a particular kind of stone as well. They wanted the right materials so for this to be a permanent and solid structure. I think it's very possible some of the stone came from the mountains up north as well as the lumber. But nonetheless, where did these... So that's the materials. You had cedar, cypress, and hewn stones. Now, we'll talk about the other materials that David had laid up, but this is what's laid out here. Okay? What was the payment? All right, Solomon and Hiram had agreed. So the wheat, that 20,000 measures, is approximately 260,000 bushels. Okay, if you that 260,000 bushels of wheat, that's a whole lot of bread right there. Okay, and you had approximately 1,670 gallons of oil. We're not talking motor oil. We're talking olive oil. Now, I mean, I know that opinions vary widely when it comes to olives. Some of you like them, some of you don't. The spiritual ones like them, the other ones don't. I knew I could get a rise out of one way or the other like that, right? But, okay, you take an olive picked off of the branch and squeeze it, press it. How much oil are you going to get out of that? Yeah, is it enough to even cover the bottom of the spoon out of one olive? Maybe not. Now, the standard way of processing olives was to put them through a press. You ever seen an old antique clothes washing system where you'd wash it, then you put it through the wringer to squeeze out as much water as possible? Well, a press would be something like that where they would try to press and squeeze the oil out of the olives. But the best oil was not done that way. The best oil was actually done by picking the olives just before they were ripe, and they would press them in, a mortar. You know, the mortar and pestle, you've seen that with medicine. You got like a little rod and a bowl where you grind powders and such. They would press them in a mortar just before they were ripe. How many olives did you have to squeeze to get 1 gallon of olive oil? My stars. No idea. Okay? I don't even want to think about it. I don't even want to think about, okay, here's 10 olives. All right? I don't have enough olive. Would I have enough olive oil at that point to fill up a medicine cup? I don't know exactly. I'm just trying to get you to think about how many olives did it take to make this much oil that he would pay for the building materials. And this was an annual payment. So every year it was this much wheat and this much olive oil, and it was the higher quality of olive oil. I did not research our modern day, you know, processes and virgin olive oil, extra virgin olive oil, you know, all the different kinds, because we go to the store and we buy it, okay? But to think in comparison, this was a barter economy, all right? I'll trade you food for building materials. You have building materials, we have food, let's make a deal, okay? But this is a ridiculous amount of food. It's large building materials, stones, lumber, you know, timber, and that kind of stuff. So this is the agreement that's made. Now, this agreement, I think, continued because Solomon spent 7 years building his own house. And how many years, 7 years building the house of God. How many years did he spend building his own house? 13, total of 20. Okay. So I think he was paying this kind of thing for a long time because once he got the building materials for the house of God and he liked it, he's like, I'm going to build my own house. And I would say maybe his wife liked it, but then we'd have to say which one or which 10, you know. But Solomon built, you know, his own house there out of the same thing. But this was the agreement. It's a lot of food, isn't it? Especially in a non-mechanized society. That's a lot of food and a lot of work to get the timbers out of there. All right, now, where did the workers come from? We're told here in the end of chapter 5 that he had a levy and he had some permanent staff. You had 70,000 and 80,000 that are mentioned in two different groups. That's a total of 150,000. If we compare 2 Chronicles chapter 2 we see where those laborers came from. 2 Chronicles chapter 2, verse 17, Solomon numbered all the strangers that were in the land of Israel after the numbering wherewith David his father had numbered them. You remember David did a census and God judged him for it? Okay, well, Solomon did this not to see how great his kingdom was, but to find help. So he numbered all the strangers, and he found that there were 150,000 and 3,600. Okay, so he took the 150,000, made them laborers. He took the 3,600 and made them supervisors. And that was his permanent staff. So when you look at the numbers in the end of 1 Kings chapter 5, those numbers pretty well match up. But where did that permanent staff come from? Well, that was all the strangers that were in the land. So they put them to work as servants. Now, it also says he had a levy of 30,000 men. What was that? You know, that word levy is like tribute or a payment or whatever. So that was basically a tax on labor instead of tax on money. They drafted 30,000 men of Israel. But they were not treated the same way as the other, you know, permanent servants. They worked for a month and then they were home for 2 months. They worked for a month, they were home for 2 months throughout this project. So what was the total workforce? 180,000, they weren't all working at the same time. How'd you like to schedule those? It'd be a little easier with the servants. You can make them come to work, right? You don't have to deal with their excuses for them calling out of work. But, you know, 150,000 people, and it still took 7 years to get this all done. That's a lot of work, isn't it? It's a whole lot of work. And we're just talking about the raw building materials right here in 1 Kings chapter 5 and 6. All right, this is just the the basic, the stone and the wood. Once they got the structure built, what was the entire inside of the temple? What did that look like? It was all overlaid with gold. So you had the walls of cedar and fir, and it was all overlaid with gold. Well, all of that came from stuff that David had set aside. David had set aside a tremendous amount of building supplies in preparation for this. But, this is kind of the magnitude. How old is Solomon at this point? This is the fourth year of his reign. Approximately how old was Solomon when he became king? 18. So he's about 21, 22 years old when he takes on this project. What do you think, Charlie? You want to manage a project like this, Sage? You're ready for that, aren't you? Pastor Stevens is sitting back there thinking, I've managed building projects for churches, and I wouldn't want to touch something like this. Okay, and most pastors I know that say, if I had an enemy, I'd tell him to start a building project. That's a good way to take years off your life. But you got a 22-year-old king, approximately, who's managing this kind of workforce and building project and all of that kind of stuff. How does that happen? Because God gave him wisdom. Because God enabled him to do what needed to be done. That's how it happened. Not because Solomon was, the greatest builder that ever lived or anything like that. It's because God gave him wisdom to accomplish the task. All right, now, chapter 6, verse 1, we've already read with the date. Look at verse 2. And the house which King Solomon built for the Lord, the length thereof was 60 cubits, and the breadth thereof 20 cubits, and the height thereof 30 cubits. All right, so now let's talk about the temple for a minute. Where was the location? Where was this built? 2 Chronicles chapter 3, verse 1 tells us it was at Mount Moriah. It's when David had numbered the people, and God said, all right, I'm going to judge you. I'm going to give you three choices. Pick your punishment. And he gave them two options, being persecuted by their enemies, or the third option was a plague from the Lord. He said, let me fall into the hand of the Lord because his mercies are great. Let me not fall in the hand of men. And so God sent an angel and he began killing the men of Israel. And David went and said, God, it's my fault. Why are you judging them? And God said, all right, stop. And the death angel, so to speak, that was carrying out the plague was right at this spot. So David went and bought this threshing floor and offered a sacrifice to God. It was that very spot that became what we know today as the Temple Mount. It was Mount Moriah. Okay? That's the location where this was built. Now, archaeologists and so forth will tell you that part of that was ready and part of it you had to be prepared. It was a mount, so there's rock, but it wasn't all level. You know, so there was some leveling work that had to be done, some shoring up and all those kinds of things. But that was the location. But we're told here in 1 Kings chapter 6, the dimensions. The length was 60 cubits, the width 20 cubits, the height 30 cubits. You understand Solomon's temple was smaller than this building right here? You know, we tend to think of it differently today because we can have lumber and sheetrock and roofing materials and all kinds of things mass produced and power tools and all that kind of stuff. The actual temple was smaller than this building right here. Okay? It was 90 feet long. So I tried to estimate that out this morning. If you saw me counting the tiles on the floor, that's what I was doing. But 90 feet is roughly from the front of the platform to the back doors at the front steps there, the foyer. It's about that long. Okay? It was 30 feet wide. This auditorium is about 58 to 60 feet wide, so it's half as wide as this. Okay? So from here to there, and as long as from here to the back wall of the lobby. That's the whole thing. Okay? Now the height is different. You know, 30 cubits, that's going to be 45 feet. This right here is about 18 feet to the drop ceiling. Okay? So it's more than double that. Okay? If any of you were in here and you know what the domed, you know, airplane hangar ceiling looked like before, the highest point of that was about 22 feet or so. So it's about double that. Okay? Miss Glenda probably remembers what that looked like. Miss Evelyn. But so anyway, it was much taller. It was more than double this height. But it was only, you know, half as wide as this building and as long as from here to there. That was the most magnificent temple of the day. Okay, our perspective is very different today because of, you know, the way we can build things and having a mechanical society and all those kinds of things. That was the basic dimensions of the temple, 90 feet by 30 feet by 45 feet high. Now, 45 feet high is extremely tall. You're going to see as we go through this, verse 3, there was a porch before the temple of the house. 20 cubits was the length, which matched the width. Okay, the building was 20 cubits or 30 feet wide, and there was a porch on the front of it that was the same width as the house. And 10 cubits was the breadth, meaning, you know, going out from the front door out towards the gate. It was 10 cubits or 15 feet. Verse 4, and that for the house he made windows of narrow lights. Now, when we think lights, we think, you know, electric lights, battery-powered lights, possibly an oil lamp. Okay? You ever had a hole cut in the ceiling of a room on purpose? You know, and a window over the top of that? What do we call that? Skylight. Some people may call it a sunlight. Yeah, it's like a skylight. All right, that's the way this was used. The lights were windows that were cut in to let daylight in. I mean, otherwise you got solid walls on all the other sides. You have, you know, very little natural light. You had a lamp stand there and such, but the windows up high were cut in to allow natural light. Any of you ever been to a service where they burned incense? I have. Yep. You ever been to they put incense in a little censer and all that, and, you know, they do the little rituals and stuff. If you're there long enough, what happens? That fills the whole room, right? And if you don't have asthma, you don't necessarily want to breathe that. Well, what was happening all the time in the temple? You had a candlestick that was burning olive oil. The priests were to keep the wicks trimmed and all that, but you've got some smoke, right? You ever used candles in your house on a regular basis, whether it's in, you know, the kitchen table or you use it in a certain room? We used it in the same place for a while at our house, and then eventually one day I noticed, why is the ceiling black there? Do I have a leak? No, I didn't have a leak in the roof, but just a little candle in a jar, if you leave it in the same place long enough, you know, the smoke rising, you're going to get black on the ceiling. So why do you have lights cut up high in the side of this? Because you got a lampstand and you need somewhere for that to go. You got incense that's going to be offered on the altar of incense. So this would provide some natural light as well as some ventilation. Okay? But that's what this is. I've got some pictures here in a minute. But the house he made windows of narrow lights. Oh, man. I just saw what time it is. I'm over. Sorry. We were just having fun. At least I was. Hope you were. All right. We'll look at the pictures next week. That'll give you something to look forward to. Okay? So we've got some really cool pictures of, you know, what the temple looked like, but you'll have to come back next week, boys and girls, and we'll tell you the rest of the story. All right, let's close in prayer.